Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll hear from a pair of students at different points in their education. They'll give their views on school during the pandemic. New data points out where in Chicago air quality is worse and just how bad it is. Making environmental improvements to combat climate change might be necessary, but it's not easy, especially when it can impact a local economy. We'll have a report. Also, state governments, including Illinois, saw a windfall in federal pandemic aid. But how that money is being used, it could set states up for a fiscal cliff. And we'll hear about a big homecoming in the town of Normal. A local singer and musician is vying to become the next American Idol. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, one of the three finalists for the title of American Idol is from Central Illinois. We'll take you to Leah Marlene's homecoming this week. We'll also talk with a couple of students about what school has been like during the pandemic, and we'll hear more about a famous board game with roots in Western Illinois. That and more ahead on Statewide. Illinois and other states got a helping hand from the federal government when billions of dollars in pandemic aid was handed out, but a new issue paper takes a look at the possibility some states could face fiscal cliffs after the COVID cash is spent. That raises concerns those states might be spending money now in ways that could lead to bigger problems down the road. I talk with Bill Glasgow. He's the senior director of the Volcker Alliance, and Professor Beverly Bunch from the University of Illinois Springfield, who authored the paper.
We focused on one particular program in the American Rescue Plan Act, and that's called the Fiscal Recovery Fund. And that's pumping $350 billion into state and local governments. The state of Illinois got $8 billion. At the state level and then more at the local. And then the state has estimated that there's $25 billion total from American Rescue Plan Act flowing into state and local governments in Illinois. So that's a lot of funds. And so this act is designed to help address economic negative impacts, social inequity in terms of the impact of the pandemic on low-income areas, as well as to replace government revenues that have been lost due to the pandemic.
It always seems to be more difficult to get something out of a budget once it's put in, because programs have constituencies. The concern here is that some states will be spending this and building up their budgets on programs that are going to need funding for years to come, and that money won't be there?
That's the big question, Sean. Nobody doubts that states across the United States are very flush with revenue now. Their rainy day funds are close to a record high. States routinely are reporting revenues way over forecasts, and they keep reforecasting. But the question is, broadly speaking, when the economy gets back to normal, will the revenue for all these programs be there? And specifically for programs that are supported by federal funds, what's going to happen when that money runs out? It has to be spent by the end of 2026.
Have most states already come up with the way that they're going to spend this money, or have some decided to delay that part of it?
We looked at the first round, the initial plan. States had to submit a report to the Treasury where things were as of end of July 2021. And about 40% of the funds had been allocated at that point. But it varied widely. California had outappropriated almost 99% of their funds. And some states, such as North Carolina, had not allocated any. And so I think we're really seeing now, when states are putting together their fiscal 2023 budget, there'll be much more coming in terms of how to spend those funds.
And of course, Illinois has already approved its new state budget to take effect July 1st. Democratic leaders have touted it as a responsible budget. They did pay down some debt and also boosted the rainy day fund for the state. But is that what your research found, that it was that they did what they needed to do with this?
Well, I think our concern is the use of one-time funds for recurring costs. So in fiscal 2022, they included some things such as $1 billion for capital, which tends to be one time, except you got to operate it and maintain it. They did assistance to businesses that have been hurt, and that could be a one-time or short-term. But what we were concerned about was a $2 billion transfer for revenue replacement into the general fund. And that's close to 5% of the general fund. There was no transparency in terms of how those funds would be used. And so our concerns is that they might be used for recurring programs. Looking to fiscal 2023, one thing they did in March, they allocated $2.7 billion for the federal unemployment trust fund loans. And in our eyes, that's a good use of one-time funds to pay down those loans, although they still have $1.8 billion outstanding. And then looking at other programs going forward, the question is, are they just going to make those short-term programs? And again, it's hard to tell based on the information we have available.
We do know from the state budget, the 23 budget, that there is a substantial amount of money going for violence protection programs. There's two programs, and it's about $300 million, roughly. Violence is not going to go away, unfortunately, within the span of the ARPA Act. So these are the programs that are necessary, but may be looking for new sources of funding come the end of the federal largesse.
Let me play devil's advocate here, because I'm sure some people will say, well, it's important to be good fiscal stewards as you go forward and not spend beyond your means. Yet there are problems right now that need to be addressed. And of course, among them, as you mentioned, business assistance, violence prevention. Is it safe to say that whether you put money into something now or put money into something later, that if it's a need, that's a good thing?
And I think we're not making the value judgment in terms of how states should be spending the funds. It's just if they're spending it on recurring needs, there needs to be a plan. And, you know, we don't know what the economy is going to look like when all this federal funding dries up. We don't know what COVID's going to look like with invariants and whether the vaccines. State of Illinois is making efforts to try to fund its budget stabilization, its rainy day fund more, but that's still a very low amount. So there's a lot of uncertainty out there. And so the issue is to develop a plan, then how are we going to sustain those programs? So it's not a matter of if there's a need for those programs. We trust the states to identify what the needs and priorities are. And certainly in Illinois, anti-violence programs are so important, but what we're concerned about is the fiscal sustainability.
Yeah, and one good thing that Illinois has done, both with its federal money and its revenue surpluses, is try to reduce some long-term costs. And this has also been a hallmark of the Pritzker administration. So the state has used federal funds to pay down its unemployment loans. That's going to save on interest and is going to prevent a tax increase, which the federal government would force on employers if the loans weren't paid. You've used money, the state's own money, to pay off other debts, pay down some of the pension debt that still will burden the state long past COVID, and you've seen the state pay down its debts to the Federal Reserve, two big loans. So these are all things that will burden taxpayers for many, many, many years to come if they continue. The state is also, as the economy recovered before COVID, the state made heroic efforts to pay down its $18 billion in past due bills that were costing 12% a year. That was a hidden tax on Illinois consumers and businesses. And right now, the state is down to about $2 billion in bills that it owes, which is kind of normal for an enterprise this size. So all those are very promising signs. You know, we hope this mood continues.
Your paper takes a look at what you're calling fiscal cliffs. Illinois' fiscal cliff, primarily, as you mentioned, there's some money put into the general fund, which is the main operating account for the state of Illinois. You're not sure how that money is going to be spent or what the future may hold for that. But at the same time, we're looking at an economy right now that does not seem to be going in the right direction. There's concerns of a recession coming that would affect income, could affect sales taxes at some point down the road. So could that also lead to this fiscal cliff?
Yeah, and I think one thing that we recommend that states do, and some states do it, is scenario planning. For example, the Office of Legislative, the Budget Office in California, they look at what happens if growth continues and what happens if there's a slowdown, and they make plans accordingly. And I think that's what we need, that kind of scenario planning. And maybe it's happening, but it's not very transparent. But the elected state officials need to see that, the public and the various advocacy groups need to see that. You know, we don't know what's going to happen to COVID. You know, there's new variants and how effective the vaccinations are. So there's a lot of uncertainty out there, and we states need to be prepared for that.
What should policymakers and the public understand about this going forward? You mentioned there a moment ago that they need to be prepared that we may see a bit of a slowdown, but I'm assuming most people are not paying a lot of attention to the state's budgets in any state.
That's true. Or they pay attention to what matters most, like my real estate taxes are too high, and why won't the governor give me a rebate or some loans, or my school taxes are too high. What can the state do about that? It all comes down to local. I think we just need to watch that we don't have an explosion of overdue liabilities, an explosion of past bills, bills for pensions, bills for bonds, bills for retiree healthcare. All of these are noteworthy pursuits, but they do need to be paid for.
Yeah, I remember once a prior governor spoke to my budget class and said, there's two budgets. One's the one we worry about that goes to pay for services. And then there's this other huge budget of all these past liabilities. And I think they both need to be on the radar and the center stage, because they're truly important. And a lot of those things Bill was mentioning, those are things that are going to affect our kids and our grandkids. And we need to do what's called intergenerational equity. That if the benefits are accruing to taxpayers and our generation now, we should be carrying the cost instead of passing it on. I think one thing we see some states doing are decreasing taxes, and it depends on the magnitude of the tax decrease as well, if it's temporary or one time. So if the states are flush in cash and a lot of it's due to the federal inflow and things are good now, then that may be another type of fiscal cliff looming if things were to change. And so one of the things in public finance, we don't like to see taxes fluctuate a whole lot. Businesses and individuals like the stability, and so they can plan. And so I think that's a concern. In Illinois, a number of the tax decreases are temporary, such as the motor fuel tax inflation increase and the decrease in the grocery store tax and the per person tax refund. So that's more in line with what we're looking for, as opposed to permanent large tax decreases that might result in a cliff.
Yeah, except for the earned income tax credit expansion, which is a very effective income support mechanism. As far as I can tell, all of the other tax increases are either temporary or one time. You can't use federal funds to finance tax cuts, but you can use the federal funds for other purposes. So the general fund has lots of money to support the tax cuts, and everything else, the fuel tax, the grocery tax, the back to school sales tax holiday, these are all either one time or time limited. And that's very important. We're seeing some other states that are looking at cutting income tax rates, going to a flat tax, which will have a much longer term effect.
That's Bill Glasgow of the Volcker Alliance and Professor Beverly Bunch from the U of I Springfield. They discuss the new issue paper, Facing Fiscal Cliffs After COVID-19 Aid Expires. It examines how governments are using that money. You can read the report. We have a link at our website at nprillinois.org. Just look for Statewide. Macomb's Convention and Visitors Bureau is celebrating the acquisition of an artifact related to the game Monopoly. Rich Egger tells us more.
Monopoly is based on the Landlord's Game, which was created by a woman named Lizzie McGee. And she was born in Macomb on May 9, 1866. The Convention and Visitors Bureau marked her birthday by unveiling a 1939 edition of the Landlord's Game that it bought early this year for a bit more than $1,000. Executive Director Jack Headblade says he's been searching for a copy for 6 years. He calls the acquisition a piece of history that Macomb is connected to, which makes it a valuable artifact for the community.
If we're going to talk about Lizzie, if we're going to try to promote her legacy, to have one of these games would be great.
The $1,000, did you have to pay with real cash or could you use Monopoly money?
That is an excellent question. We actually had to pay with real cash for that, but it was well worth it, well worth it.
The game is on display outside the Bureau's offices in Macomb's Amtrak station. Headblade would like to create the world's largest Monopoly board, either virtually or physically, on Macomb's Courthouse Square. But he says it's been a challenge working through the red tape at Hasbro, which owns the rights to the board game.
The irony of it is, you know, there's now a monopoly on Monopoly.
And he says the Landlord's Game was designed to be a protest against monopolists. Local genealogist Alan Nemec concurs with that description of the game.
She invented the Landlord's Game, the precursor of Monopoly, to illustrate the teachings of a progressive heir economist, Henry George.
Nemec says in addition to being a Georgist, McGee was also a game designer, inventor, poet, actress, writer, and outspoken advocate for the feminist movement. Nemec celebrated the anniversary of her birth by portraying the character Rich Uncle Pennybags, also known as Mr. Monopoly. Nemec was dressed in a black morning suit, a black top hat, and a red bow tie. Rich Ugger reporting.
There is more to come on Statewide, a hometown concert for an American Idol finalist. That's next. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A Central Illinois singer and musician has gained national attention from the show American Idol. In fact, Leah Marlene from Normal is among the last three finalists. A winner will be chosen this Sunday night. But first, Leah made a trip back home to perform before her hometown fans. Eric Stock has more.
Thousands of Leah Marlene fans lined the streets of Uptown Normal holding signs saying, "We love Leah," many wearing her favorite color, yellow. It's all being filmed as part of the American Idol finale on Sunday night. Fans were loud and proud to show support for their hometown hero.
I'm Stella Hammer and I'm from Clinton.
How long have you been a Leah Marlene fan?
I just watch American Idol a lot with my mom. And when I saw her singing, I liked her voice really much.
Do you want to be a musician, performer yourself?
Yeah, I'm actually, I'm in fifth grade right now. And when I go on to sixth grade, I pretty much want to play the flute in band.
Does Leah's performance kind of inspire you as a aspiring musician?
Pretty much. It really does. I like her music.
Can I have your name, young man?
Preston Bourne.
Where are you from?
Normal, Illinois.
And your name?
Adrian Bourne.
Now can you tell me what your sign says?
My sign says, "We are not normal, Katie."
Now do you think Katy Perry is going to be here?
She might watch this.
That's true. She'll see it. And yours?
My sign says, "You are amazing, Leah."
What do you think is so amazing about Leah?
She's a great singer.
And you can't have Leah Marlene Day without a marching band and an official proclamation. Here's Town of Normal Mayor Chris Coos.
So, Leah, when you were about 12 years old, sitting in front of Windy City Wieners with your hat out, and I put a dollar bill in your hat when you were playing, I never imagined that it would come to this.
Me neither!
But it did come to this, and here you are. And welcome home.
Do you know how many times I played right here? Literally right here. And sometimes there's like two people in the circle. Sometimes there's a lot more. But there sure as heck has never been this many people in the circle.
The moment we have all been waiting for. Our girl, Leah Marlene, is home. Coming to the stage tonight could very well be the next American Idol!
Can you feel the breeze as it strokes your skin?
Then it was time for Leah Marlene to do what she does best. She took the stage and performed a free concert. It was part music and part therapy.
The 2 years leading up to the show are the two worst years of my entire life. And holy moly, if you told me a year ago that I'd be looking out at a sea of thousands of people right now as a finalist on American Idol, I would have never in a trillion, billion, kajillion years believed you.
When you're 6 feet under, it's hard to hear the fracture. But new light is growing in the layers you've shed.
This is only the beginning. There's so much that's about to start after this show, and I hope I see you guys there in the very near future. I love you guys so much.
We'll find out Sunday night if Leah Marlene is indeed the next American Idol. But for the thousands who came to see her perform at Uptown Normal, she's already their idol. At Uptown Normal, I'm Eric Stock.
There's a power outside far stronger than this.
The poor air quality in some Chicago neighborhoods has been known for decades. But new data from a city-backed air quality sensor project provides a closer look at when or where air quality is at its worst. Maria Inez Zamudio has this report.
The 31st Street corridor in the Little Village neighborhood divides the mostly Mexican immigrant community from one of Chicago's busiest industrial corridors.
Buenos días, ¿cómo estás?
Muy bien, ¿y usted?
Bien, bien,
gracias. Irma Morales has lived in this neighborhood for almost 3 decades. She's showing me around today. There's a scrap metal recycling center and an asphalt plant at opposite ends of the block. A mile from there, two elementary schools where 1,200 children are enrolled. This corridor is busy. There are a lot of trucks. We counted 8 in 5 minutes. At that pace, there would be more than 750 in a typical workday.
Son muchos los trailers, los carros que tienen.
Morales blames a massive new Target warehouse. It's over 1 million square feet, and it brings hundreds of trucks per day to the neighborhood. The warehouse replaced a former Crawford power plant, a coal plant Morales campaigned to close for 12 years.
Logramos que cerraran la fábrica esa. ¿Para qué?
We closed the plant, she says. But what's the point of working for years to close the coal plant to have it replaced by another polluter, the Target warehouse? She wonders why it's so difficult to advocate for clean air in her community. Morales said even building the warehouse polluted the neighborhood. 2 years ago, a botched implosion of a 378-foot smokestack left the neighborhood blanketed in dust.
¿Por qué nos están vendiendo? Porque es como nos sentimos.
Morales said she feels like the city is selling her community's air quality to the highest bidder. A 2019 city planning document touts the Little Village Industrial Corridor's proximity to I-55 as, quote, a strategic advantage to attract new companies and investment. After consulting with the city and community groups, Microsoft installed more than 100 air sensors throughout Chicago last summer. Most of them were placed on top of CTA bus shelters. The sensors measure air quality every 5 minutes, providing a more detailed view of pollution in many Chicago neighborhoods. Little Village was identified as an air pollution hotspot, particularly during the evening rush hour. Many sensors with the highest particulate matter 2.5 readings are located near Chicago's industrial corridors, like this one in Little Village. Those readings also showed high PM concentrations in neighborhoods situated near traffic-clogged highways and interstates. That's according to an analysis of air quality readings by a team of reporters from the Sun-Times and the journalism nonprofit Muckrock. On a recent cold Thursday morning, Javier Roman with JC Deco is setting up a ladder to reach the air monitor on top of the bus shelter at Cottage Grove Avenue and 53rd Street. Roman is here to reset the air sensor because it stopped working. It's shaped like a leaf and it's white.
So this is the device in our reset. So every time this magnet goes behind it, what it does, it resets the...
The solar power sensors collect readings on fine particulate matter, or PM2.5, essentially tiny particles in the air that can lodge deep into the lungs, causing serious health problems, including heart and lung disease. Continuous exposure to PM2.5 contributes to poor birth outcomes, developmental and mental health issues, cognitive decline, and even reduces life expectancy. In 2020, during the first year of the pandemic, life expectancy in Little Village fell by 4 years. That was the third highest decrease in any community in Chicago. Activists from this community fought to close the coal plant, then demanded to know how the city approved the smokestack implosion. Activists also held protests at City Hall and outside the home of Mayor Lori Lightfoot in an effort to stop the Target warehouse from opening. Kimberly Weiserman with the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization says politicians claim they listen to community.
And yet our voices are ignored and City Hall's agenda is pushed forward. From bike lanes on the west side where community doesn't want them, to communities voting on a development of youth services and getting a warehouse instead.
City officials said the goal is to use the real-time hyperlocal data from air sensors to make decisions. The city's health department acknowledges that traffic is a known source of air pollution and said it is providing health-based recommendations to other departments. Weiserman said Chicago mayors have a legacy of breaking promises they made on the campaign trail. She issued this call to Lightfoot and any others who want to run for mayor next year.
The days of dysfunction and business as usual must end. Equity, transparency, and accountability can no longer simply be election marketing gimmicks left to the wayside. There is a need for reforms in the city of Chicago, starting with the Chicago Department of Public Health, and a process in which community voices can truly be built in and integrated into policy.
Last month, Little Village residents gathered near the site of the implosion that left the neighborhood blanketed in dust. It was a 2-year anniversary. The vigil honored residents harmed by poor air quality. And it started with this indigenous prayer.
Ofrendamos humo de copal a nuestra tierra madre, Tlalitonantzin.
Moreno told the crowd it's important to transform anger and frustration into activism. Moreno said the community was energized after the closure of the power plant and opposed the warehouse with protests and petitions.
También quiero reconocer la ira que muchos de nosotros todavía tenemos hoy.
We need to acknowledge that anger is the fuel that keeps some of us in the struggle, she said. It's that anger that keeps them fighting for better air quality. Marina Zamudio, WBEZ News.
For decades, doctors have factored in a patient's race when it comes to the way they diagnose and treat kidney disease. And now some hospitals have decided to stop using that approach. Side Effects Public Media's Farah Yousri explains.
I pulled into a mall parking lot on a recent Saturday and immediately noticed the black Nissan parked next to me. The car had signs plastered on all its windows that say,
kidney donor needed, and has registered to be a living kidney donor by scanning the QR code.
This is Crystal Moore. She wears a black hoodie emblazoned with a similar life or death plea. Moore is 59 and lives in Indianapolis. She has stage 5 kidney disease. Her kidneys are unable to filter her blood of waste and excess fluid. On her worst days, her feet and hands swell, and she's extremely fatigued. Stage 5 patients typically have 5 to 10 years to live. Right now, her best bet to extend her life expectancy is to find a kidney donor.
So I'm just asking or begging people to, if you're interested, to please help me. I need a living donor. I just want to live longer so I can spend more time with my grandbabies. and with my boys, my kids.
About 37 million people in the U.S. have chronic kidney disease. Data shows black patients like Moore are more likely to have kidney failure than white patients. They also make it onto the transplant lists later, and once there, wait longer to get a kidney. Indiana University nephrologist Sharon Moe says there are many reasons for these disparities.
Part of that is due to some genetic risk factors, but also lack of access to healthcare, medication costs, insurance.
But also the digital calculators doctors use to make treatment decisions. Mo is among many kidney experts who worry they may cause delays in care for some black patients. The calculations measure kidney function by determining how well the small filtering units called glomeruli are working.
Each kidney has a million of them, and it's basically like a vegetable colander, so it's got little holes in it.
A so-called GFR score tells doctors if there is damage in those holes. The lower the score, the worse the damage. Now, here's where it gets a bit complicated. The gold standard to measure kidney function involves infusions that are pretty invasive. So researchers in the 90s developed another method. They looked to see how fast a patient's kidney is able to flush out a chemical everyone has in their blood already, one that's made by muscles called creatinine. Levels of this chemical vary depending on your age, weight, and sex. They came up with mathematical equations, an algorithm, that takes those variables into account and spits out a number for a patient's GFR that is pretty accurate compared to the more invasive tests. But for the small fraction of black patients in their study, researchers noticed that creatinine levels at baseline were higher compared to white patients. That threw off their GFR scores. So they introduced a multiplication factor to black patients' scores, which gave more accurate results. But there's a caveat. Here's nephrologist Sharon Moe again.
We don't even really know from the studies done 25 and 30 years ago how race was actually captured. Was it self-reported? You know, was it somebody looking at somebody and deciding?
Still, the assumption was made that anyone who looks black has more muscle mass and therefore higher levels of creatinine. And so from the get-go, doctors used algorithms that inflate black patients' scores. That has consequences. A higher GFR could give doctors the impression that a black patient's kidney is healthier than it actually is. Then, Mo says, they might not get listed for a kidney transplant when they need to be.
You might spend more time on dialysis before you get a kidney transplant. Our goal is always to get a kidney transplant before ever needing dialysis.
Black patients may also miss out on early interventions. Crystal Moore and others like her may never know the extent to which the race has influenced their treatment. But studies suggest if race is removed from kidney disease calculations, more than 700,000 black patients in the U.S. could have better outcomes and quality of life. It's why some hospitals have decided to stop using the race-adjusted calculations. That includes Indiana University Health, where Mo works. Kidney disease is just one area of medicine where doctors use race-based adjustments. Cardiology, obstetrics, urology are among others, says Dr. David Jones. He's a professor at Harvard Medical School who studies the unintended harms of this approach. Jones says medicine should not be colorblind, but doctors need to recognize that many health disparities are not caused by race, but racism.
Is there ever a case to be made for dividing the world's people into black versus white and then treating them differently depending on which of those two buckets you've been put into? That's what U.S. medicine does most of the time. Most of these race-based tools rely on a black-white dichotomous variable.
Back in Indiana, Moore usually wraps up her work as a home health aide around noon and drives home from the town of Carmel to her home in Indy's Martindale-Brightwood neighborhood. It's 17 miles. That coincides with a 17-year gap in life expectancy, 1 year for each mile from the wealthy, predominantly white suburb to the majority black and brown neighborhood where Moore lives. Between her demanding job and caring for her elderly mother with dementia, she tries to take care of herself, and that includes her nighttime routine.
I hooked up my PD catheter to my machine for my peritoneal dialysis.
That machine does what her kidney can't. It filters her blood every day.
I will be on it for 12 to 13 hours.
Her prayer as she drifts off to sleep each night that she might stumble upon a kidney donor soon. Farah Yusri, Side Effects Public Media.
Side Effects Public Media is a regional reporting collaboration focused on public health. Well, stay right here. We have more to come. You're listening to Statewide.
We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll talk with some students about what school has been like during the pandemic. Corn, soy, and wheat make up about 70% of Midwestern farmland. But as the planet heats up, scientists are developing new crops to replace them, plants that can survive and even thrive in a changing climate. Rachel Yang produced this story with the Food and Environment Reporting Network. It's about one crop that some scientists and farmers think could be the grain of the future.
Now, this is the stuff we're going to be planting this in that field right out here.
Carmen Fernholz has been farming organically since before the term organic farming was even a thing. He owns A-Frame Farm in Madison, Minnesota, where he grows corn, soybeans, and small grains, including one you might not have heard of.
Right now, we have about 80 acres of kernza.
Kernza, a species of wheatgrass. Some scientists and farmers say we need to change the crops we grow in the face of climate change, and kernza could be part of the answer. It's a crop that can feed both people and soil in a warmer world, which is a dream come true for Carmen, who cares a lot about keeping his soil healthy.
I just cringe every time I see soil disturbance.
By soil disturbance, Carmen means tilling, churning up the soil to plant new crops. Tilling releases carbon into the air as a greenhouse gas. It disrupts all the processes that make soil healthy. Most corn and soy farmers have to till their fields every year because corn and soy, those are annual crops. Kernza is different. It's a perennial grain, so its roots get to stay in the ground for several years while the plant above ground keeps producing grain each season. Those roots pull carbon out of the air, they build healthy soil, and they make kernza resilient to extreme climate events like droughts and floods. And if kernza really takes off, farmers will be able to make money growing it.
It's exciting, and to me it's just a tremendous gift to our food system.
Kernza is also helping Carmen imagine a new future of growing grains. He says he chats with conventional farmers all the time who see problems with the way we farm today.
They're seeing soil degradation, herbicide resistance, increasing costs of production. They're sort of on a treadmill with corn and soybeans, and are looking for something to break out of that.
People are very excited at perennial grains.
Tim Cruz is the chief scientist at the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas. They're the ag research organization that's been developing kernza for the past 20 years. And they want perennial grains like kernza to replace the annual crops we grow now. That would mean doing away with a lot of that annual tilling and adding the environmental benefits of perennial roots like kernzas on millions of acres of the world's croplands.
And it's just a matter of getting them to the point where they can actually start to replace the annual crops economically.
But today, there are just about 4,000 acres of kernza growing worldwide, most of them in Minnesota. Minnesota is also home to a small but enthusiastic kernza supply chain as local brewers, bakers, and chefs experiment with niche kernza products in microbrews, pancake mixes, and dessert bars. National brands are starting to pay attention. Kernza was listed among Whole Foods' top 10 food trends of 2022. Still, don't expect to see Wheaties swapped out for Kernzies in the cereal aisle anytime soon. University of Iowa economist Sylvia Secchi says that for kernza to actually replace the grains we grow now, we'll need to see major changes to the U.S. Farm Bill first.
You can't just change the crops. This is a whole system that we need to modify.
Part of that system? Federal subsidies for annuals like corn and soy, which incentivize farmers to grow those crops, even if they end up losing them to extreme climate events.
What we need for kernza to find its place is changes to our farm policy. For example, if you have crop insurance subsidies for corn and beans, right, you should have them for kernza.
Farmer Carmen Fernholz isn't waiting for changes to the federal farm policy. He's been mentoring young organic farmers for a farming future that benefits the earth instead of degrading it.
To start seeing the next generations being engaged in it, there's nothing more rewarding.
For the Food and Environment Reporting Network, I'm Rachel Young.
The effects of climate change are becoming more pronounced across the country. That means local communities will need environmental improvements that are tailored to their individual needs, but understand their economic reality. Eric Schmidt reports from St. Louis there is not a one-size-fits-all solution.
The Reverend Roderick Burton clearly remembers when a nonprofit approached his North St. Louis church with a plan to manage excess water from large rainstorms. Burton says the proposal was a rainwater catch basin at the local community center.
What they were saying was, well, look, you know, we would do the project, and then afterwards there'll just be little cost for you to sustain it. And they were just saying how we needed to do this.
The project also would have eliminated parking at the community center, something Burton says was a deal breaker in the end.
Parents need to be able to get their kids to our childcare center. People in the community needed the various programs and resources that we had and needed the space to be able to get there, so they were not on a dangerous street.
He says the principle of the project aligned with values at his congregation, New Northside Missionary Baptist Church, which has been an environmental advocate for about a decade.
In theory, yeah, we were for it, but it just was not going to work for us.
Burton says it was a situation where the outside group wanted the project more than community members did. Other St. Louisans have similar stories. Charlie Cooksey grew up in North St. Louis, not far from Burton's church. She says she was baffled when roads like West Florissant and Natural Bridge suddenly had bike lanes. Cooksey says those roads see lots of traffic, making them dangerous for cyclists.
I still find frustration when I drive down those major streets in my family's neighborhood and realize, like, these bike lanes were not designed with the residents in mind, not to say folks don't like bikes.
Cooksey is now the CEO of WePower, an organization she founded to build economic and political power in Black and Latino communities. She says her work includes asking people in majority Black and brown neighborhoods across the region how they define a community's vitality.
Continuously, we kept hearing the environment, we kept hearing green space.
Projects to develop these and other climate resilience are gaining steam. For example, Illinois's 2021 Climate and Equitable Jobs Act gives money and other resources to places where the economy is tied to fossil fuels, and for communities, often of color, that have been overburdened with past pollution. Maurice Mouillet is a climate advisor with the International Environmental Advocacy Group, NRDC, and a city council member in Richmond Heights.
We can't divorce environment from economic performance or from societal benefit, right? They're all intertied with each other and interdependent.
He says prioritizing one over the others will negate any possible benefit. Mouillet says it's not hard to redesign a road with more trees or add renewables at a community center. The challenge is in making sure those solutions fit what locals want.
You can't go to a standard because there's no standard for that. You have to develop that on the fly, right? And you have to make sure you develop it for the long term.
This will look different for places throughout the St. Louis region, even if the environmental challenges are similar. Each area, from urban to rural, has specific economic conditions that change what's needed.
Pollution is so hard because it's often invisible.
Patricia Shuba is the president of the Labadee Environmental Organization, a group of residents that pushes for stricter rules on the local coal-fired power plant. She says the Labadee Energy Center in Franklin County has contaminated nearby land and water, but
we impact the air pollution of a whole region. So one could say part of the just transition from Labadee is to remediate for that air pollution in St. Louis City. And I would agree with that.
Shuba says she wants locals like her to have the chance to decide what happens next.
There's an obligation because our communities, much like the coal mining communities in Appalachia, have paid a price for everyone to have convenient and cheap energy.
Burton echoes this thought and says the new green economy can be as exclusive and unjust as the old one.
There's got to be equity built in and not lip service. You got to actually take the time and do the legwork and have the humility to listen to people in the community.
Cooksey agrees and adds local residents are going to know what their neighborhoods need the most.
The solutions that come from community, that have buy-in from community, will be the most sustainable versus a corporation coming in and doing a few projects here and there.
She says good intentions aren't good enough, but they can be a starting point. I'm Eric Schmid.
Devin Snow is about to graduate high school. Destiny Hudson is going into eighth grade. Both have had to learn through the pandemic, but at very different steps in their educational journey. Peter Medlin sat down with them to chat about what school has really been like for them the past 2 years.
What are the words that come to your mind when you think of what the last 2 years have been like for you?
I would just say more understanding. I feel like teachers are a lot better at communicating with the students now that they have to do everything virtual.
I agree. I think that I'm going to say challenging. Then it was more challenging to like show how you feel and what you're going through the computer. Wow, if you're in class, you're overwhelmed with something, they can see that.
Yeah.
And you couldn't really see that online, so.
How long were the both of you learning, like, at least partially from home, whether it be fully remote or in a hybrid?
Pretty much. Mine was up until, like, the very end of sixth grade.
So all the way up to the end of last year, right?
Yeah.
And what about you?
Mine was from the initial lockdown until, or throughout all of last year.
And so, like, when all of this started back in March of 2020, you were in fifth grade?
Yeah.
And now you're almost going to be in eighth grade. I mean, and for you, I have to imagine that it kind of feels like you missed out on a lot of high school, right?
Yeah, for sure. I feel like a lot of, like, the memories I normally would have, like going to prom for the first time, I missed out on a lot of things. The school definitely tried their best, but it really wouldn't be the same.
And, like, the actual remote learning that you guys ended up doing, you said that one of the words that described the experience was, like, challenge.
Yeah. And in sixth grade, it was really difficult because I play the trumpet, and so I had to learn my instrument online. And then I wasn't used to having, like, five different teachers, and so I was adjusting to them giving me work and not mixing it up from different classes.
Right.
And then having, like, a deadline and not being able to redo stuff. I think the school made it, like, easier. There was counselors here to talk to you. They made it known. But I do think it was more difficult than I expected it to be.
Did you guys feel like there was enough access to those type of mental health resources if you needed them?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Definitely.
At the high school, so we had a program that was called SEL lessons. So every Thursday, I believe, we would take one period out of the day and just talk about the whole acronym stands for social emotional learning. And so it's just like a lesson on, like, different, like, coping mechanisms and that type of thing. Because they realized that, like, being stuck at home for an entire year is not really the best situation to be in and definitely impacts your mental health. So they made sure that they were reaching out to us and letting us know that we were understanding that they were there for us.
Were there, like, extracurricular clubs or sports or things like that that you guys either missed out on or were different than it could have been?
I know you said you're in you did trumpet. You just started like during this full year of COVID, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
Did you have, like, in-person concerts or anything?
Yeah, we did. We had fun a concert online and then record ourselves, and then they kind of all banded it together.
Ooh, how did that go?
It was great. It was really good. We now play it now in person. We play it as a memory looking back, and I think it's really cool to do that. But I think it was really difficult to learn that concert by myself and not knowing how to hold the instrument.
Yeah, I can imagine it. Are there any parts about your experience learning during the pandemic that you just think that more people should talk about? Or you're like, I don't think that they quite understand what this has been like.
I think I'm still stuck on, like, social. I had this one friend that we spoke to, and my friend, she didn't have a phone, like, so we didn't get to, like, text or call each other over that. And so it was really weird. I was by myself pretty much. Like, I was with my family members, but I didn't really get to have kids my age around me talking to me. And I thought, then I thought that I was the only one going through these emotions and experiencing all this work piling up, and, like, I didn't really feel good about it. And then when I got to school and kids started talking about it, I realized I wasn't the only one going through it. So I don't think people understand how much pressure it put on you and how you have to hold yourself accountable.
I'd say the biggest thing that I see people talking about that I don't really agree with is the whole movement to go fully back in person. I really did not like remote learning. That's not my favorite thing at all. But with the whole pandemic going on, I feel like a lot of parents, they didn't really understand the students' views on COVID. Because at least with a lot of my friends, they were a lot more nervous about, like, the dangers of COVID, especially when it's, like, really new. I feel like a lot of parents just skipped past that and, like, their students' views on it and just pushed their own views of, like, seeing their kids, like, struggling in in their classes and stuff. And then thinking that they need to go in right away. Like, there's the two sides of the story that I don't think will get represented fairly.
You'll see a lot of parents that had really, really strong opinions about that and about masks specifically.
Yeah.
Did you guys find that that was even, like, really an issue that students really cared about one way or another?
Not really.
What are some of the positive memories that stick out to you over the last 2 years of really cool experiences you've had?
I took AP US History last year, and so there was a lot of debates that we had. It was a massive debate, just one side or the other, so it's like a group of like 15 people, each working on a side. And for my side, everyone actually made a whole group chat, and they were like working outside of it. I'm friends with all of them now.
That's Devin Snow, about to graduate high school, and Destiny Hudson, who's going into eighth grade, and both talked with Peter Medlin about school during the pandemic. That's all the time we have for Statewide. Be sure to join us next week. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Statewide episodes can be found at nprillinois.org. Just look for Statewide. Also, our weekly podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.